Live from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We have a power program. We're going to be talking, of course, about health and nutrition, how men, well, if you're not getting a good night's sleep, there's a problem. And one of the solutions could be nature. We'll be sharing that with you. We'll also talk about a link between physical activity and staying healthier as you get older. Also, how common prescription pharmaceuticals can make you angry, violent, irritable. In fact, it can make you kill. We'll show you the latest study on that, how dark chocolate increases your attention, and a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to explore some other topics. And in depth, we're going to explore the crisis in the marketplace. I have a person coming on that all of you have heard before, Gerald Salante. Now, if you remember, about 7 weeks ago, Gerald and I predicted that we'd be going into a major meltdown any time between mid-October and January. So, this was a correction. Will it stabilize? Will it continue free fall? We're going to explore it from a different perspective and give you some ideas of what you can reasonably expect. Then my guest in the second part of our program is M. Jackson, environmental educator, two-time Fulbright Scholar, currently completing a doctorate in Earth Sciences, University of Oregon, where he specializes in glaciers and the Arctic and climate change. And he has been a National Geographic expert on its expeditions and has won over 20 awards for his endeavors. We're going to talk about the environment from a different perspective today. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. A lot of people don't get a good night's sleep, and there are a lot of simple reasons for that. Most of them are not complicated. Let me just go through the reasons that you don't get a good night's sleep, that you could do something about. We stay up too late, passing the biological clock. We start throwing our circadian rhythms out of balance. You see, from about 8 o'clock in the evening to about 11 o'clock, our body starts to get ready for its catabolic, meaning resting, detoxification process. Then we go into a deep sleep, and that's restorative. That's when the metabolism slows down, your heart rate slows down, your body temperature's a little less. You burn calories, and you cleanse the body. Dead cells, fibrous material, bacteria, they're eliminated out of the body. Then in the morning, from about 4 a.m., you start becoming anabolic, building up high energy, and it peaks around 11 o'clock in the morning, and then goes into a fairly common medium where we're not energized and we're not fatigued until about 4, and that's when people start wanting to take a nap, and should, if they can, 10-15-minute nap would be great for you. And then we start this whole cycle all over again. Well, you can see how many times you've been dead tired at 10 o'clock, but you decide to stay up and watch a movie. Now it's midnight. Now you're no longer dead tired. So now you try to sleep and you can't. We also take stress to bed with us. Always try to ask questions that you want to see resolved the next day on a sheet of paper before you go to bed. I want to address A, B, C, D, whatever the questions and issues are. That way, you're not taking them to bed with you. Your mind has already said, all right, these are for tomorrow. I'll address them tomorrow. You could also take a nice Epsom salts bath and take 1,000 milligrams of magnesium from citrate. That'll calm you. That'll relax you. So these are some things we can do. We could take melatonin and don't eat before you go to bed within 3 hours, because that'll turn your metabolism back on. But there's one thing we never talk about, and this is from the University of Illinois College of Agriculture, published in Preventative Medicine. Quote, men and persons 65 and older who have access to natural surroundings, whether in its green space or a nearby park or a sandy beach with an ocean view, report sleeping better. It's hard to overestimate the importance of high-quality sleep. Studies show that inadequate sleep is associated with declines in mental and physical health, reduced cognitive function, and increased obesity. This new study shows that exposure to a natural environment can help people get the sleep they need. So, here's the takeaway message. If you live near a natural environment and you just are able to open a window and breathe in nature, it's especially refreshing when it's raining out, and especially in nice weather when there's rain, or in the fall when you can smell the crispness of the leaves in the air, or when grass has been cut, or you can hear the ocean. But most people don't live near nature. So what do you do if you live in an apartment and you're not going to get that? Simple. You can buy simple CDs that have the actual sounds of nature. I know I made one of these years ago. It took me a month. Every night, I would take my high-quality microphones out and place them right at and around a pond. And you could hear the crickets and the frogs. And you could, when it rained, you could hear the water splashing and hitting the leaves. I would put microphones under leaves and then a tin roof. And then I mixed all this together with flute music, and it was just wonderful. Well, having a CD you can listen to about 20 minutes before you go to bed, that'll help you go to sleep. Now, let's say that you watch television. Half hour before going to bed, there are these really beautiful and just majestic scenes of, it looks like an eagle, but it's probably a small airplane, and it's flying through the Grand Canyon or through the Boreal forest, and then the rainforest, and around waterfalls all over the world. And you're watching this, and you're just transposed to that place. So watch that, and then that gives you that nature fix. So whether we are actually in nature or whether we are watching it, listening to it, that helps get a better night's sleep, which can extend your life and expand your brain. All good. From the United Kingdom's Institute of Food Research, that would be like our FDA, published in Lipid Technology, is a new good study on the omega-3 fatty acids and how they help the good, the friendly bacteria in your gut to grow. The findings are important. Why? Because we can help prevent colorectal cancer with the good bacteria and the good fatty acids. We can turn off inflammation in the stomach and in the intestines from good bacteria and the omega-3 fatty acids. And you have a better immune system. So my suggestion is this. Take 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams a day of the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, the idea would be to get them from the sustainable and replenishable flaxseed and the oil flaxseed. But you can also get them from fish oil. Either way, it's good for you. Now, something that is not good for us are all these pharmaceuticals that we're getting without there being first an examination by the physician. Is this the only approach? Now, if it is the only approach, fine. But is this going to harm the patient? Is there greater likelihood a patient will end up being adversely affected by the medication than the disease? These are questions that have to be addressed outside of the existing medical model, which has failed miserably for chronic diseases. Works beautifully for acute illnesses and emergency medicine. But the chronic diseases, diabetes, obesity, depression, heart disease, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, it doesn't work. This is the latest study. Listen up. Quote, from Natural News, feeling irritable, paranoid, or even violent? Before you blame other life triggers like your job, money problems, or your significant other, you might want to examine your prescription drug regimen, as it could be changing you in more ways than you realize. Close to 70% of Americans are taking at least one prescription drug, and more than 50% of all Americans are taking two or more. And that's from the Mayo Clinic. Prescription drug use rose from 44% in 1999 to 48% in 2008. And the most common are antibiotics, but then right behind those, antidepressants and painkiller opiates. More than 35 million Americans may be on a drug that causes violent, suicidal, and homicidal behavior. And it's not antidepressants. About 25 million Americans are currently taking statins. And under new guidelines issued this year, another 13 million may be eligible for the cholesterol-lowering drugs. Now, I do not have time today, but I will, on a program later this week, go into the latest investigation on statins and show you what kind of massive fraud they are. When I say massive fraud, I mean massive. So while they are touted as being nothing short of a miracle for preventing heart attacks and stroke, which they don't, a new study says statins may cause some terrible side effects, including, quote, aggressive, violent, jealous, suicidal, even homicidal behavior. Researchers from the University of California found a link between statins and aggression, particularly in postmenopausal women over 45 years old. And a separate study out of Pennsylvania State University found that women taking birth control pills were more jealous because of the effect of the pill on their hormones towards their partners. So another big thing that we can do is get off the statin drugs. And unfortunately, so many people have bought into the idea that they're great, and they're not. So that's important to understand that. Also, as you become more physically active, and I suggest people power walk because it's one of the few things that most people can do without a problem. And a lot of malls in the United States open up early in the morning to allow those people who want a safe place and in inclement weather, a good place out of the snow or rain or heat to power walk, generally before the malls open. This is in the University of Illinois at Urbana. Doctors are now recommending physical activity to improve your brain. And what they're now saying, based upon this new study published in PLOS One, quote, we looked at over 100 adults between the ages 60 and 80, and we used accelerometers to objectively measure their physical activity over a week. And what we found was, according to them, that they observed how blood oxygen levels changed in the brain over time, reflecting the brain's activity at rest. And they found, quote, we found that spontaneous brain activity showed more moment-to-moment fluctuations in the more active adults. And there was other studies to support this. So, lay language, when you're bicycling, swimming, stationary cycling, power walking, you are increasing the blood flow and oxygenation to the brain, and that creates a greater mental flexibility, especially if you're older. And finally, from our health and nutrition segment, dark chocolate. This is a good one because it shows that people who have the healthy dark chocolate, and this is according to the publication Neuroregulation, plus theanine, you've heard me mention it many times in this program, that's what you get with green tea, and it helps calm the brain but keeps you alert. And it's great if you have agitation, stress. Take 200 milligrams theanine. But here's what it says. Quote, previous articles show chocolate can change the chemical activity of our brains. It's particularly known for raising dopamine, a neurotransmitter associated with focus, pleasure, and motivation. But in this current study, they use people 18 to 25. They were given 60% dark cocoa chocolate, and or the others were given zero, and plus they were given theanine, and the results show that the dark chocolate and the theanine, not the placebo and theanine, made measurable changes in blood pressure and mood before and after for at least 60 minutes. So here's the takeaway message. Maybe in the afternoon when you're feeling a little sluggish, a little tired, take a 2 ounces of dark chocolate with 200 milligrams of theanine, or how about having some green tea and eat your dark chocolate and follow it with some ice green tea and get your theanine that way. You're going to be more alert and feel better. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back with Gerald Salante. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world, because we have people listening right now on land-based stations all over the United States, but also people listening almost in every country of the world. And I pay careful attention to your emails, the issues that you find important. Well, today I was flooded with emails involving the environment, and I had so many people said, wow, how prophetic. I was listening a couple months ago to you and Gerald Salante talking about what's coming, and you nailed this. You nailed it. You said there's a tsunami coming. It's going to happen in the early fall, and which is 2 weeks away. So we've invited Gerald back today to ask him what he sees the outcome to be. Gerald is one of today's pioneers in trend strategy. He founded the Trends Research Institute in Kingston. He is the publisher of the Trends Journal. And he has become one of the nation's leading diagnosticians and forecasters because he is so uncannily accurate. His website is trendsresearch.com. Nice to have you with us today, Gerald.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Gary.
Okay, Gerald, I want to open with a larger overarching issue and then turn it over to you to run with it, all right? It was a conversation you and I had 7 years ago. And 7 years ago, we were discussing the bubbles before anyone else, the Fed or anyone else, acknowledged them. And we discussed the idea that you can fool most people as long as you have certain indices that are rising, like the stock market going up or the dollar being strong. And they believe the forecasters. Oh, we've got a solid future. And I'm saying people are buying on credit. There's an enormous amount of margin out there, and the amount of corporate debt is, at that time, was over $20 trillion in corporate debt, trillion. And now it's higher. And I said, if you take a look at the total sum of all of our debt, credit card debt, student debt, a homeowner's debt, and you look at how many Americans have lost their job, 30 million at that time from 1973 until then, and you look at who's coming in on visas, highly educated people to take the jobs of our senior citizens, senior employees who've worked for 20 years, they're quietly getting removed and replaced by someone who is highly educated and trained, and they're not showing up anywhere. There's no news about this. By the way, it turns out there's 8 million. 8 million. People have been brought in from other countries on these special visas to take the place of Americans. Not a word about it in the media. So you and I discussed, and what we really discussed was the fact that we are going away from a manufacturing society to a service society. and a manufacturing society can be sustainable, providing you live within the means of what you're creating. A service society is virtually unsustainable for the people, and that's where we've been from the mid-70s. And if you look at the lower terms of wages and benefits, you look at the loss of any form of a community cohesion because society doesn't have working people, and instead the money is shifted over to the finance sectors. So our gross domestic product calculations are not being educated to the people, saying, hey, the only part of our whole gross domestic product really thriving is Wall Street, but that money doesn't trickle down to anybody. So if you take Wall Street out of the equation, you take the banks out of the equation, you're left with 0.3% from 2000-2015. So there has been no growth at all, and U.S. productivity peaked in 1972. And the productivity decline has been unprecedented, yet there's no one out there talking about the fact that we offshored our jobs, we got rid of the working middle class, and that's what we're left with. So where does that play into our current crisis and the bubbles that have been escalating? The form is yours.
Well, first of all, on the H-1B visas, what you were referring to about all the cheap labor coming and the highly educated, you know, I've been writing about this actually going back to the mid-1990s when I came out with Trends 2000, one of my books. It was a national bestseller in 16 different languages. And you can see the trend taking place. And ironically, the people that pushed for most of this, it was also that when we used to have manufacturing, the National Association of Manufacturers, and of course, Silicon Valley. And it was to bring in cheap labor so that they wouldn't have to pay the people in this country high wages so their profits would go up. It's simple as that. And now it's expanded into every field with lawyers, doctors, professionals at all levels. They're bringing them in, and as you said, they're pushing out the people that have been in these jobs for many years that are highly skilled and closing the door for highly skilled young people to move into them. And it's not being reported at all, as you mentioned. This all began, you know, with this whole breakdown actually began with the Reagan administration. And what Reagan and Bush couldn't push through, Bush won. Bill Clinton sold the nation out with NAFTA and all the deregulations of the Federal Communications Act, Glass-Steagall Act, and all those people that love Hillary and all the other liberals out there. These are the people that also gave us GMOs, bovine growth hormone, and made Monsanto a wonderful, wonderful company. So going back to it all, it's been the great sellout of America. And this is not capitalism, so I keep hearing a lot of people complaining that, you know, that you're watching capitalism decline as Marx and others said it would. This is not capitalism. And you and I have talked about this as well. Four words killed capitalism if anybody forgot them. It's too big to fail. In capitalism, there is no such thing as too big to fail. But the people that were too big to fail were the too big. And now you see, again, going back to the Clinton administration and all the deregulations of the Glass-Steagall Act and others, but also the Robinson-Patman Act, Sherman Antitrust Act, Clayton Antitrust Act, that allowed we the people to be mom-and-pop stores so that the big people wouldn't grab everything. So the multinationals have taken over. So what this is really called is fascism. It's the merger of state and corporate powers. And the only people that have benefited since the too big to fail and Obama's plan when he came in with TARP under Bush and Obama's plans of spending nearly $1 trillion to regenerate the market, the facts are all there. The only reason the stock markets have gone up, everybody knows this, and even the prostitutes on CNBC and Bloomberg and the other business channels now admitted that the only reason the markets have gone up is because of the 0% interest rate policy. The Federal Reserve has not raised interest rates since 2006. Once upon a time, people used to have a thing called a savings account, and they put money in the bank, and they got more back on what they put in on interest, and they actually used to retire on it. That's gone. Going back to where where the bonanza has come from. So now these big companies, they buy back their stock because they're borrowing money for nothing. You borrow money for nothing, you buy back your stock, that drives up the value of your stock, and you become richer. Number two, these are facts. Merger and acquisition activity right now is on pace to be the greatest in the history of the world because of the record low interest rates. So you're seeing these deals for $32 billion, $55 billion, on and on and on virtually every week because they're borrowing money for nothing. Again, concentration of wealth. They buy out other companies, fire a lot of people, and they grab more dough. Going back now, the big cycle of it. And as you mentioned, when people see the stock markets going up, they see other little indicators that they keep hearing and hearing over and over again, they think that there's a recovery. And there has been no recovery. It's only been a cover-up because you mentioned some of the data. And also included in that data is that real median household income, as we speak today, is below 1990 levels. The gap between the rich and the poor is the widest in the United States of any of the industrialized nations, and now even supersedes that of when it was the Gilded Age in America, when they put in place, began to put in place the Taft, the Robinson-Patman Act, Sherman Antitrust Act, Clayton Antitrust Act, so the robber barons wouldn't rob us of everything as they have now. And another factor in adding these things together is that household ownership levels are down to 1960s levels, and first-time home buyers, usually younger people between the ages of 26 to 36, first-time home buyers usually have about 40% of the market. Now it's 28%. They can't afford it because they also have something that's brand new in American society that people have become used to that ties into what you were saying before, and that's record levels of debt. Who ever heard of students getting out of college with $100,000, $120,000, $60,000, $80,000, $40,000 worth of debt? This is how you're going to begin your life? Of course you can't buy a home. You're going to be an indentured servant for the rest of your life. Oh, and you could thank the indentured servitude for those wonderful Democrats as well. And I know they love to turn a blind eye to the people that shaft them the most. That's right. It began under the last years of Bill Clinton, pushed by Joe Biden when he was senator of the loophole state down there in Maryland, and pushed through during the Bush administration, championed by Biden, so that you will be a you'll be an indentured servant for the rest of your life.
Cheryl, let me interrupt for a moment because I'm very concerned that the nation, Mother Jones, by the way, I'm going to be challenging Mother Jones. They just wrote a very positive article on food irradiation. I helped lead the fight for 5 years against food irradiation, and they didn't cite any of the science. They should have. They cited pro-industry scientists. In any case, beside that, what you have today is true liberals and true conservatives you never hear from. You hear from the corporate liberals and the corporate conservatives, but let us not forget about Joe Biden. Wasn't he the one that drafted the core of the Patriot Act in 1995? Wasn't he the one that voted for the war in Iraq? Isn't he the key politician inflaming the Ukrainian crisis and provoking Russia? And his son stands to profit handsomely from the chaos? Didn't he falsely claim that there was no doubt that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons on its own people when the facts were that it was the ISIS, not the Syrians? And he is the consummate insider. He defends Wall Street bailouts. He supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He supports prosecuting whistleblowers and trying to outlaw encryption and privacy and backing other corrupt policies. This man is the perfect embodiment of everything that a good Democrat corporatist is today. But that's only part of it. I want you to listen to Democrat average people all on at a beach where They will ask a simple question about Hillary Clinton. Now, mind you, these are declared Democrats, declared Hillary supporters, but listen carefully to the question and their answer. I'd like your response on it. Let's play this. Our engineer in New York, please. This is called The Best Argument Against Democracy. Just a conversation with average voter. We're getting a, I'm just told that our, we had a problem on the audio clip. Anyhow, every one of the people on there, when asked, do you believe that we should get rid of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution because it's old and it's getting in the way of progress, every single one of these people said yes. Listen, they say they got it back. Okay.
Clinton's primary campaign promises is to repeal the Bill of Rights to help with the New World Order. Do you think it's time we get behind her and support the repeal?
I think it is. I think we need change like they've been promising us for so many years. I think it's time to get behind Hillary Clinton and do
support her repeal.
And support
the Bill of Rights.
Yes, I really do.
They're just too old.
I think
200 years
you
old.
You can't have the rules of yesteryear. Now,
those freedoms are just so outdated.
It's so much has changed. So much has changed. People have changed. There's just we live in a different world now.
We were just checking to see if the Hillary Clinton supporters support the plan to repeal the Bill of Rights.
I support it.
You support it.
I support it.
Okay.
I sure do.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Her plan to repeal the Bill of Rights, about time we do that for her?
I think it's a good time to look at it, for
good
sure.
Good time to look at repealing the Bill of Rights for Hillary?
Good time to look at it,
All right. Hillary Clinton's primary campaign platform is to repeal the Bill of Rights, to move America forward. Do you think that's a good campaign promise? Do you think that we should get behind her, regardless of what political party you're with, to support the repeal of the Bill of Rights?
I do. I think so.
Obviously, you're Hillary.
I'm stuck in between. I'm a little Democrat and I'm a little Republican. I'm not the extreme of either or. So,
but you do support Hillary Clinton.
I do.
And so you support the plan to repeal the Bill of Rights. Her big promise to move America forward.
Yes.
Just checking. We're just interviewing Hillary Clinton supporters to see if they agree with her primary campaign platform of repealing the Bill of Rights. So that you do support that.
I do.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
One of Hillary's primary campaign promises is to repeal the Bill of Rights to help out with the New World Order. Do you think it's time, should we get over bipartisan differences and support Hillary Clinton's plan to repeal the Bill of Rights?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I haven't been following lately.
You think Hillary Clinton has the right idea to repeal the Bill of Rights to help with the New World Order?
Possibly.
You think it's time maybe we support that?
Yeah. Might as well let everyone do their own.
A little bit too old, I guess.
Somewhat outdated.
One of Hillary Clinton's primary campaign promises is to repeal the Bill of Rights to help progress the New World Order. You think it's time we get on board with her and repeal the Bill of Rights to help America progress?
Sure, I do. I have nothing more to say.
Nothing more to say.
No, I don't talk politics. Ask her. We'll see what she says.
What do you think about Hillary's campaign to repeal the Bill of Rights? Do you think it's time we do that to progress society forward?
Yeah, I think so.
You think it's time to get over partisan differences and support Hillary Clinton's plan to repeal the Bill of Rights?
I don't know. I really don't have an opinion with it.
It could be good. It could be bad. You're just not sure?
Yeah, it could kind of go both ways. Depending on what exactly they're doing.
Repealing the Bill of Rights could be good or it could be bad.
Yes, I know. I'm in the middle.
Okay.
Yeah.
You probably saw one of Hillary Clinton's primary campaign promises is to repeal the Bill of Rights. You think it's time we continue with the progressive agenda and support Hillary's campaign to repeal the Bill of Rights?
Well, you know what? I absolutely think I have an unorthodox way of thinking when it comes to politics, and I agree with a lot of Hillary's policies, and I do agree with...
Okay, Gerald, over, I think, 35 straight people agreed that we should abolish the Bill of Rights. It's old. It's worthless. What does that tell you about the average person?
It tells you how biased they are in their beliefs, number one, and that they will turn their back on any fact and get swayed as easily as you can sway them if they believe in a person or an ideology, and the facts don't matter. And one of the interesting things was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but most of these people were women that were Hillary Clinton supporters. So here's our trend forecast from the spring edition of the Trends Journal when we started to outline the presidential reality show. And that's, of course, before the reality show champion, Donald Trump, threw his hat into the ring. We said if the election were held today and Hillary Clinton survives, at this time it was the Cash for Influence scandal, we forecast Clinton as the winner. On issues of gay rights, women's rights, abortion, Cruz, Paul, Rubio, Carson, Fiorina, and Huckabee will find weak support among a sizable portion of women voters. With all the candidates, including Clinton, on the same war page and none presenting strong and unique economic policies to truly create jobs and increase wages, what separates Clinton from the guys is the girls. Quote, Chelsea Clinton, female president, will make a substantial difference, USA Today. In the 2008 election, presidential election, we go on to write, 70.4 million women cast ballots versus 60.7 million men. In the 2012 race, Obama won the two-party vote among female voters by 12 points, 56% to 44%. So that's what's going on, as we see it. The people, again, as I said to you before, and I've said this, you know, about how the Democrats and people that call themselves liberal will lie at the facts and support anything that's shoved down their throats in any way as long as they could hold on to their belief system.
One final issue. Do you see the trajectory being down at this time, what we stabilized, and the fact that virtually every media outlet that I turned to yesterday, whether it was Al Jazeera or MSNBC, they all and Fox, they all said the same thing. This is just a slight correction. It will stabilize. Stay in the market. Don't panic. And yet I have, this is from August 4th, before this, economic collapse, 8 financial experts that are warning that a great financial crisis is imminent. We're talking about Doug Casey and Bill Flechtenstein, Larry Edelson, John Hussman, some of the heavyweights, not a word about it. Then we have this from Future Fast Forward, the U.S. King Dollar Has No Clothes, America's Toilet Paper Money by Matthias Chang, talking about how just printing more money, as the Federal Reserve does, will not get us out of this particular crisis that's coming up. This is, mind you, I've held these are all before the current downturn. This is from Monty Perelin, Economic Noise. Only the date is unknown. The U.S. and world economies are frauds that are coming unraveled. The Greek bailout is the most recent example of kick the can down the road solutions. U.S. housing bubble was an attempt to cover up and recover from the dot-com bust. Now the U.S. is in a financial bubble engineered to recover from the housing bubble debacle. Soon this bubble will burst. Only the date is unknown. Two predictions can be made with reasonable confidence. Mind you, this is 2 weeks ago. Quote, the stock market is likely to be halved, meaning cut in half, and that might be optimistic. Only the date is unknown. The economy will eventually resemble the Great Depression. Only the date is unknown. And then you have that. Then you have this. Doomsday clock for global market crash strikes 1 minute to midnight as central banks lose control. China currency devaluation signals endgame, leaving equity markets free to collapse under the weight of impossible expectations. This is from John Ficine of The Telegraph. By the way, a highly respected journalist and making statements. This, again, is before the current crash, and it goes through the markets. Credit markets roll over. Dominoes begin to fall. Resource sector credit crisis. Commodities collapse. These are each titles. Interest rate shock. Bull market thirds longest on record. And those are some of the things that have not been discussed. Your thoughts on where we're going from here forward, please.
Well, we discussed it before these people, actually, and you and I have as well.
Yes.
I believe I was on your show, what, August 5th or 6th?
Yes.
And you asked me, and I said, before the end of the year. And we've been sending out trend alerts, as you know, showing the decline in commodity prices. And now what they're doing, Gary, is they're blaming all this on China. China's economic woes, China devaluing the yuan. China's only the canary in the global equity mine. It's signifying what's going on around the world. It's not China could lower their yuan all they want. They're not going to export much more because there's a global recession underway, and people refuse to talk about it. You're seeing commodity prices, by the way. When I was on your show, they were down at 13-year lows, according to the Bloomberg Index. They're down to 16-year lows now. We're talking 1999. So what we're looking at, the Brazil, Venezuela, Chile, Ghana, Australia, Russia, Canada, name the country, from raw materials to milk, whether it's New Zealand, you're seeing commodity prices crashing. As those commodity prices are crashing in these countries, their currencies are plunging. As the commodity prices and currencies are plunging, unemployment is rising. As all of that's happening, social unrest. Look what's going on with oil prices. Look what's going on in the Middle East. All of a sudden, Saudi Arabia is what? They started a war in Yemen. They're not making the news at all, slaughtering innocent people, the poorest nation, Yemen, in the Middle East. And what are they doing? They're one of the biggest buyers of military equipment. I think they rank fourth or third in the world. And now they have to issue bonds. Because for Saudi Arabia to keep its economy at equal, oil has to sell for over $100 a barrel, and it's now Brent is approaching near the $40 mark. You're going to see global destabilization worldwide. It's not about China. China is saying, our exports are down over 8% last month because the Americans, the Europeans, and the rest of the world don't have money to buy the products that we're manufacturing that your companies are selling. It's as simple as that. But they're finger-pointing to China. It has nothing to do with China. And by the way, overnight, the Shanghai Index was down another 7.5%. 7.5%. The Nikkei Index down another 4%. And this is after Abenomics pumping in trillions of yen, into the system to boost it, and exports are falling as well, even though the yen is devalued in Japan. It's a global recession headed toward a global depression, and the worst is yet to come. And all I say to people is prepare for the worst. Because if the worst didn't happen, you didn't lose anything. But if the worst happens and you're not prepared, you lose everything. Watch for things like bank holidays. Watch for a terrorist strike or false flag or real as an excuse to call a bank holiday because those terrorists are trying to take away our freedom and liberty, and we have to do something to prevent it. If you don't have your money on you, you don't own it. I learned that from my MF Global incident, when MF Global, the commodities exchange trader, when they robbed me of my money out of my segregated accounts, when John Corzine, the former senator and governor of New Jersey, was the head of that, former head of the Goldman Sachs gang before that. I learned it when I tried to make sizable withdrawals out of HSBC and Key Bank, and they wouldn't give me my money. When there was economic problems, I wrote about it in the Trends Journal. So all I'm saying to people, do what you want, believe what you wish, think for yourself. As we see it, crisis is not on the horizon, it's in front of our eyes.
I would agree with that, and that's why I've been telling people, do not buy houses, get out of debt, tear up your credit cards, and keep your cash. I believe that the artificially deprived gold and stock are going to go through the roof. And it's just a matter of time. The dollar will become stronger initially, but then it's a fiat currency. There's nothing backing it up. And so people had better pay attention because we are there now. And I'm not in New York today. I'm on my way back. What's the market at today?
Well, the market right now, the U.S. market is up about, it's 350, up 2.2%, and they're making it a big deal. It's up 2%. How much did it fall yesterday? It was down what? Almost 600 points?
Yes.
And again, you know, we've been forecasting this on and on. We did, after I did your show, we did on Trends in the News, our weekly broadcast, we said on August 6th that there was going to be a market crash sooner rather than later. And I mentioned in that broadcast that the market had been down for 6 days in a row. Gary, I've been around a long time. I've never seen a summer like this. You're seeing trading volume that's at near highs. Usually you don't have a crash until October because people are in a vacation state of mind. Not now. There's never been a summer like this where you're seeing these declines happening like this.
You're right. Well, all we can do is bring it to people's attention, as we have in the past, Gerald. Hopefully the wiser ones will take heed of it. Thank you very much, Gerald, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all that you do.
Gerald Celente, his website is trendsresearch.com. Now, we're going to go to our next guest who is standing by. I'm going to run this interview a little longer than normal. I want to let our stations know because I want to get what M. Jackson, an environmental educator, has to say, and I'm going to give you his background in a moment. Let me just mention that tonight on the Progressive Comedy Hour, the most listened to hour of the week that I do, we're going to do a full hour on yesterday's discussion, exposing the verbatim transcription statements that were made by CDC top scientist Dr. Thompson, William Thompson, and Kevin Berry, a former top government lawyer and whose son is a victim of autism and a vaccine-related injury, will be here along with Professor Mary Holland and Dr. Bob Sears, a board-certified pediatrician, the whole hour about corruption at one of the government's agencies, the CDC, Center for Disease Control. That's where all this is playing out. So understand, we got the FDA, you got the USDA, but you got the CDC. These are the clowns that did the Tuskegee experiment, among other things. Totally corrupt. And we're going to show you who there is engaged in fraud and malfeasance and how we can hold them personally accountable with lawsuits against them individually. That's tonight, 7 o'clock, Progressive Commentary Hour. But now let's go out to Eugene, Oregon. We're standing by is M. Jackson. And I gave his bio earlier in the program. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Recently, there's been some positive efforts being made in grieving therapy, which is usually associated with the mourning of a loss or in a death and dying and hospice work, to enable people to better face and grasp the consequences climate change and global warming is doing, but in a positive way. And too often, people who spend a great deal of time looking at climate change and its rapid progressive confrontation end up with periods of deep depression and a malaise that hinders all optimism and hope. And while the prognosis of humanity's future and that of numerous other species is grim, nothing can be accomplished to lessen climate change impact unless there's some degree of hope and courage to act and be resilient in our actions against all odds. And since I brought on this program many scholars and scientists and activists confronting climate change over the years, please summarize for us where you stand on the direction our civilization is taking right now with respect to confronting climate change and the threats it poses to our lives and our society that we as we know it.
That's a very big question. But what occurs to me is that I study glaciers, mainly in the Arctic, and I have an emotional response year after year. It's really hard work that I do as I go back and I see glaciers each year a little bit smaller, a little bit different. And I do a lot of climate change advocacy. And so I talk to a lot of people about different aspects of climate change. And often the way the conversations end up is almost a tone of hopelessness. There is a great deal of sadness surrounding climate change. People see their landscapes changing. They feel powerless. And they don't know what to do. And they seem to focus on when the worst happens. That's a language I hear a lot with climate change. When it happens, when it actually occurs. But we don't think beyond that.
Okay, well, everyone listening right now has likely confronted the loss of a loved one in their lives, whether a parent, a child, a spouse, or best friend, or colleague. And frequently people reflect on how they would have acted differently with that person only after they have passed away, and we experience regrets. How can the loss of someone and the memory of that loss, which remains with us years after the fact, be employed constructively for confronting the climate change challenges ahead? And what role does our imagination hold for moving us beyond malaise and depression to become more proactive?
When I wrote the book, While Glaciers Slept, the reason I wrote it was because my parents both died of cancer, and they spent a couple of years kind of moving towards the worst happening, moving towards their death. And it was a very painful death. And as a scientist, I became aware that the same language that I was hearing while I was grieving and experiencing my parents' sickness seemed to be the same language that people were using for our planet. And what I think about today is that I could not change, as many people cannot change, their grief outcomes, the sadness of losing family members or a lover. We're aware these things are happening, but we cannot change the course of them. And to paraphrase Mike Hulme, when we talk about climate change, at some point we have to think about a climate-shaped future. What's happening to our planet is not something we can switch off. But what can be done is the way we think about it. And that requires a lot of imagination. If we focus just on the worst, just on that apocalyptic scenario, what actually is happening there is that we aren't moving beyond grief. We aren't moving behind the very dark, very worst thing that we could potentially imagine. And so that ends up limiting any potential response at any scale, whether that's an individual response to climate change, or that's a local response, or something at a governmental level. And I think what is helpful moving forward with climate change is a recognition that we are in a grieving process. We are responding to the fast, very different changes around us.
Isn't
and we're limited here with how we respond because we're still grieving. And once we move beyond that, we're going to start being able to have a greater imagination, a greater response that depends on being able to begin talking about what's happening. And instead, we don't talk about it too much now. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I travel all over the world. My latest film, Saving the Planet, you'll see film footage from almost 60 countries. And one of the things you'll notice is that in other countries, and more native populations, you'll see actual grieving for the loss of the planet, loss of the trees, loss of the streams. They actually grieve for this, and then they try to gain some sense of perspective on it. In the United States, we seem to be distracting ourselves from our grief. We don't embrace our grief. And therefore,
we're
really
fixated
learning
on
lessons.
That worst, that moment, versus the actuality that this is happening.
Well, let's go into that. The melting of the glaciers is one of the fundamental tipping points that climate change researchers all acknowledge. So speak on your research in the glacial retreat, especially in the Great Himalayas, because think of how many people are impacted by the Himalayas. You're talking about China and India. You're talking about 2.7 billion people. And it is speeding up, not slowing down. And what is the likely result of the loss of all glaciers and its tipping point being reached, and how would this affect the pace of climate change?
There's the crux of my researcher, pardon of my research. So I'm at the University of Oregon, and what I'm studying is not necessarily the physical side of glaciers themselves. We have a lot of really great research already done that's telling us glaciers on all seven continents are all responding a little bit differently to climate change based on localized conditions. But what we don't know, and this is what I do, mainly in the Arctic and Iceland, is what impact that glacial recession has on the people living near it. And there can be things like ecosystem services, so just water. Your water will change. But what I'm interested in mainly is the emotional side. In Iceland, a lot of people can look right out their kitchen window and they see glaciers. And part of being Icelandic is having a relationship with the landscape. So what happens when you look at a landscape that's being dramatically affected by climate change? And you can look at this type of research and you can take glacier out and you can place in grassland or trees or river. What happens to the people who live on this planet when they watch the landscape that they're tied to dramatically change, and they know that change comes back in many ways to themselves and to how they live on this planet? We don't have a lot of good data that tells us anything about that.
My final question is, as an educator, you have found, or have you found, any viable means to convince the climate change skeptics? And this has become a real challenge today unless more and more people rise and speak out. Then we are being challenged by the idea that the media is not supporting climate change as a group, and our politics is not. They talk all the time, but very little concrete action. In addition, trying to appeal to a skeptic's intellect with facts and statistics doesn't work, since it is the emotions and feelings that are well known to have the greatest impact upon changing a person's perspective. And yet nothing systematically will change and business will remain as usual unless another way is found to convince the deniers, and particularly the deniers in power. So what suggestions would you offer people who find themselves dealing with climate change deniers?
That's a hard one to come up with, because, I mean, everyone who works in climate change remains first a human being. When I first started doing the publicity for my book, I attracted a great deal of climate change denier attention. I received a great deal of hate mail, so much so that I wouldn't want to open up my email. And at that time, that made it harder for me to go out and have positive conversations with people. People are limited by their imagination about the information that they hear. And so if you don't have other people going out and having really positive interactions that aren't predicated on ignorance or anger or fear. I mean, I work so much in this field, and I don't hold it against people who don't understand climate change. I try to share with them as much as I can, because it is scary, and I'm in the field. If you're not in the field, climate change is terrifying. It makes sense at some level for people to deny it. But I think talking about it, decharging it, having daily conversations about really local changes that aren't quite so embedded in politics can be a great place to start.
I agree. Thank you very much. And thank you also for great work while glaciers slept, being human in a time of climate change. And the website is greenwriterspress.com. All the best to you in educating the public on this. It's needed. Well needed. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's M. Jackson from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Don't forget tonight, 7 o'clock, a powerful hour you won't want to miss.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy,
oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, cause the woman that you love is gone.